Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove, and with me today to talk about Celestial Navigation, a fan favorite, are the Kellers. For the first time, siblings on our podcast. Clay Keller, co-host of the Screen Drafts podcast, and Britt Keller, production designer, West Wing enthusiast, and perhaps most importantly, a Keller, is here to talk about The West Wing, Celestial Navigation. I want to rewind for a second and ask you both how The West Wing came into your lives. Did you watch it in 99? I'm assuming not, but I'm curious as to when you might have watched it.
When we might have watched it. I did not watch it in 1999. Right when it started, I was watching TV. We were both watching TV. TV was on in the household. And actually, we were an NBC household in the Keller house. We watched the NBC local news, Carol Evan in Minneapolis, St. Paul. That was our local news channel. And then we watched our mother.
Must-see TV.
Must-see TV. Our mom was a big Mad About You person, big Friends person. Frasier was on before that, Cheers. So we were always kind of an NBC house. And then there was some ER going on. But the first time I saw The West Wing was when I was in high school in No, not in high school. It was, I was in high school. I saw an episode in AP US Government, and I thought, Phil, actually, I think I told you this story the other day, but I was like, oh, this West Wing, this seems fun. This seems up my alley. And it was currently running. I think it was season, sure. I want to say, season three is when is when Mark Harmon would have been on?
Yes.
Or is he season three. Two? So three. Season three, I watched my first episode. It was, you know, it was back in the day when there was 25 episodes of a show every season, and you would just drop in. Things were episodic. You didn't have to start at the beginning. So I turned on the West Wing, which actually, a lot of tangents on this, usually was unable to watch because it was on Wednesdays for a long time.
It was always on Wednesdays.
We were at that time, we were doing like youth group on Wednesday nights. So I was often not home on Wednesdays.
What's a youth group?
Youth group is like Wednesday church.
Oh, okay.
Wednesday night church, the kids go and it's kind of like a young, it's like
social
a hangout
thing.
Church, sure. Social, yeah. Social thing.
Cool.
Phil, I cannot believe you guys just did an episode on the Omega Code. I can't believe youth group didn't come up.
Yeah, who knew that a Jewish Canadian wouldn't know what what youth group is?
So it kept me away from the West Wing. But whatever, youth group was canceled or they had it. It was a re-airing on a different something. Anyway, I'm watching the West Wing. Great episode. They're going to the opera or whatever. But I'm really locked in and invested in this romantic relationship,
sure,
between Allison Janney and Mark Harmon. I'm like,
how'd that work out for you, Clay?
This is my favorite part of the show. I really like this Secret Service character.
Yeah,
I'm super into Mark Harmon. And then, of course, spoilers for the West Wing season three.
Three finale. Yeah.
Mark Harmon gets killed at the end of the episode. And I said, well, fuck this then. I'm not watching this show. My favorite character is already dead within the space of one episode. So I didn't go back to it for a long, long time. Then in college, I figured this would come up, and I was trying to remember why I got into the West Wing in college, and I genuinely can't remember, but I burned through all of it. And then it was, I went home for Christmas, I think it was, junior year. And then Britt and my mom and I watched the first season through, and then very quickly Britt surpassed me as the number one West Wing fan in the
family. Jumping on my storytelling time, Clay.
So how did it come into your life, Britt?
So my older brother, Clay, it was probably about when he was in college and I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started hanging out and being friends. And I would go, when he was home for summers, I would go hang out with my friends until my curfew at 11. And then I would come home and him and his friends would be at our house. And I would then hang out with them for a few hours. And so that's when we started watching a lot of TV together and movies and whatnot. And it was back, I think, yeah, Netflix was still DVDs in the mail.
It was still, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he showed us West Wing. And then I think, you know, it's that thing where you just try to get all of the DVDs. I think, sure, Clay had a Blockbuster and a Netflix.
So, and I was working at Blockbuster at the time.
Yeah. So we could get so many CD or DVDs in the mail at one time. So it was easy. We had it. We had the system game so that we could binge even just through snail mail.
This is this is how gamed we had the system. Phil, I don't know if you remember as a Jewish Canadian, but Blockbuster had a program where you could do the discs in the mail, then you bring them to Blockbuster and exchange them immediately for an in-person disc, and they mail you another disc. So I had that going two at a time,
and
I worked at Blockbuster. So I was getting, at any given time, I had 7 to 10 Blockbuster discs rotating through. And yeah, we dedicated a lot of that to the West Wing.
So, I mean, earlier before you hopped on mic, Britt, Clay was saying that he's probably seen the whole thing through maybe 2 or 3 times. How many times do you think you've seen the West Wing through?
There's like the real answer, and then there's like the answer that's okay to say when it's being recorded. I, like 5 years ago, I did the math on how many hours of my life I've spent watching The West Wing. Not fun math. I'm not going to do it again. But I have probably seen it through like 8 or 9 times, if
awesome.
Not more.
Awesome. Yeah.
It's kind of one of those where it's just such like a comfort. It's like a safety blanket. It's a comfort food.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that I've definitely watched the first 4 seasons at least that many times. I'd be lying if I said that I've done 5, 6, and 7 that many times. But yeah, it's a very, very comforting show. And I kind of wanted to ask you both about, you know, this is actually the last episode I'm recording of this miniseries. It's a little out of order, but this is the last one. So through the course of all of these episodes, I feel like everyone sort of had their own relationship with the show, obviously. But I feel like that relationship changed a little bit when Donald Trump became president. I think that a lot of people felt like this show was a bomb. It was a really comforting thing to give you hope in politics. And then there's other people that feel as though it gave us a sort of an unrealistic, naive perspective of politics, and thus made what happened over the Trump administration hurt that much more. And I'm curious as to sort of how the show has evolved for you, if it's changed, how you see it now through a different lens in 2021.
Yeah, I definitely hit kind of all of those roller coaster of emotions. I think when, sure, for the first few years of Trump, I the thought of watching The West Wing was just like, no, it's too like, that like utopia that we wish existed that doesn't really ever exist, even when we have an administration that we want. It was like such a bummer, and it was just like so too hard to like be like, we're so far from that. But then then you just have to go back to it eventually, and mm-hmm. you know, it's those characters, and if it is, you know, the comfort food, it stays the comfort food, even if it is like annoying to watch that utopia and know that it's not anywhere near what we want, or at least like the people doing their best and trying to be their best.
Sure. I think it also, you know, it's interesting because I feel as though for a lot of people, it's something to strive for. I mean, there's a lot of people that feel as though trying, you know, television shows about us being our best, I put that in quotation marks, but that idea of like the ideal is something to strive for at the horizon. It's a good thing to have that. And whether or not it's completely plausible is moot to me, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, at least that's how I watch the show.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just curious what, you know, this the same thing as Britt. I didn't watch any West Wing during the Trump administration because I thought it would not that it make me like annoyed at how naive it was or something, but because I you know, didn't want to be reminded of how far away, even if it was an unrealistic mm-hmm. vision, how far, far, far away we were from it at that given time. And I was worried I wouldn't be able to just focus on what I loved about the show. But I'm curious, you know, that refrain people go back to that you were just explaining, Phil, that it gave us unrealistic expectations and all of this crap. I'm like, okay, but like, what damage did that do? Like, I don't know. Was The West Wing so pervasive that it, you know, ruined the political minds of a generation? Like, I never really understood what was inherently evil about having an unrealistic portrayal of the White House. Every single television show is a rosy, you know, surface level portrayal of the thing that it's portraying.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement.
I'm sure
you.
Sports Night is a naive view at at ESPN, but you know, no one cares about that.
I think that the again, playing devil's advocate here, more sort of speaking other people's perspectives on this, it does feel a little bit like maybe most specifically the Obama administration, which felt like such a seismic moment, understandably so, and a lot of people being like, we're finally getting our West Wing administration, mm-hmm. and then it not playing out the way that we wanted it to. Right. I think that it's a perception thing. I don't necessarily think that the West Wing, you know, rotted the brains of America into thinking that something was possible when it isn't. But I think that there are people that perhaps just were felt like they were somewhat promised a bill of goods, I guess, by certain administrations. And I don't uh-huh. subscribe to this idea, but it is what some people think. Now, I do think that this show also just, and I think specific to this episode, found the levity in politics, and found the humor in politics. You know, Aaron Sorkin probably considers himself a comedy writer in some way or another, an ill-advised thought perhaps, but it definitely...
His first show was a half-hour comedy.
It was. It had a laugh track, and then it didn't.
I mean, and then Sports didn't Night, have a laugh track kind of again at the end for a few episodes.
Yeah. Like it did all sorts of shit.
Season
like, they
three
really
of Sports Night is odd.
It's a lot. It's a crazy show in its own way. But I do think that in you know this episode specifically, I think is a fan favorite for a bunch of reasons. But I'm curious as to why this was an episode that you guys picked. I gave you a bunch of episodes, and I was like, which one do you want? And you jumped on Celestial Navigation. Tell me why.
Britt, do you want to explain the really intense process that we went through to land on this episode?
I mean, we went through, I think a little bit of it was Clay trying to remember if he knew what happened in the episodes just by their title alone. Played into it.
I did not at all.
Love when people are out of the office. It doesn't happen a lot, so it's fun to see people in those different settings, and we kind of got a little bit of it in this one. This one's fun because Allison Janney gets to play. Those are some of the hot button loving points of this episode.
Yeah, I always enjoy when the staff members of the Bartlett administration get to go out into the countryside and condescend to the yokels.
So you love the season four premiere when they're stuck out at the
end. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, with Amy. No, Amy Adams is she in that episode? She's at the beginning. She's not one of the
20
people.
20 Hours in America.
She's not one of the people by the bridge. She's like in the first part of the
episode. She's not one of the people by the bridge. That's what's his face from Newsroom.
Yes. So it was everything Britt said. And then also Britt and I were on a cross country road trip and I kept going, Phil keeps texting me. We have to pick an episode.
That feels right. That tracks. Yeah.
So we landed on Celestial Navigation.
For the record, it was because I was, you know, trying to schedule other people into their episodes.
Absolutely.
It wasn't just because I wanted to be an annoyance on your road trip. But it is appropriate that you're on a road trip and pick this episode. So I'm going to read a very brief synopsis. Sam and Toby are dispatched to Connecticut for some damage control to secure the secret release of President Bartlett's choice for the Supreme Court, who has been jailed for alleged drunk driving and resisting arrest. Meanwhile, Josh, a guest lecturer at a college class to talk about working for the president, recounts the previous week's flare-ups, which include his feeble attempt to fill in as the White House spokesperson at a press conference, where he promises the president has a secret plan to fight inflation, and the media glare that engulfs the African-American HUD secretary, who publicly labeled a prominent Republican as a racist. Celestial Navigation aired on January 26, 2000, story by D.D. Myers and Lawrence O'Donnell, teleplay by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Chris Misiano. 13.48 million viewers tuned into this episode. So Aaron Sorkin has a quote here. He says, on Celestial Navigation, I just knew one way or another I was putting cotton balls in Allison Janney's mouth. The whole episode evolved out of a prank on her, but really because I have such respect for her as a comedian, which I think is pretty amazing. And also not surprising in the least that something as small as that could turn into this episode. But I kind of want to, we'll go at sort of each individual storyline. But before we do that, I want to ask you guys your thoughts on the format of this episode. And by that, I mean a fractured narrative, which seems to be a hot button issue on Twitter of late in terms of the idea of starting in one place, rewinding, and then sort of finding your way back. Personally speaking, it doesn't bother me as much as it seems to bother other people. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't surprise me that Aaron Sorkin likes it because it creates tension, sort of a temporal tension between what's happening and what's about to happen. But do you have thoughts on this this narrative structure?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with this episode, it doesn't really even feel like it's a choice because the whole format is that Josh is telling a story. So it really is just like so obvious about what's happening.
Right.
And the West Wing does it a lot with a lot of, you know, 72 hours earlier and whatnot. So even in this episode, you don't even notice it. But in general, I love it.
Yeah. Josh in particular has a couple of great episodes that follow this format. On an episodic level, I have absolutely no problem with it. I occasionally get annoyed when a show will do it on a show/season level. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because as I've ranted to you before, Phil, when you do that, you occasionally get storytelling kicked down the road like so many tin cans. And then it just ends up seeming like they just are not deciding not to do anything until the last episode because they've all got some big twist or something. So that will start to bother me on an episodic level in a show like this. No, I think it's way it's done here.
I tend to agree. I know that there are people that, you know, the two shows right now that feel as though they're kind of the lightning rod for this is Physical, which is on Apple, the Rose Byrne show, which sort of starts in one place, does a fast forward, and then some people might argue is treading water in some capacity or another in order to get to sort of the finale. And then White Lotus, which has a body drop at the top of the show, but it's not really a body drop in the same way. Like, it's not a murder necessarily. Like, it feels like it's almost deconstructing this notion. But all that being said, I agree with what you're saying, Britt, that like it's a storytelling device, like a literal storytelling device, in the sense that Josh is at this school, as I mentioned, and he's sort of regaling the students with the week's events. So to your point, it feels a lot more organic. So it didn't bum me either. But Dee Dee Myers was interviewed. I have this quote from her. Dee Dee Myers had such problems she was the press secretary for the Clinton administration. And she talked about how this show was sort of an opportunity for her to kind of get revenge on sort of the people. I imagine that for her, it was being a press secretary is not a fun job. It doesn't seem like a fun job. It seems actually like a pretty terrible job, quite honestly. And I think that for her, it was fun to be able to use CJ as an opportunity to be able to sort of be the best version of what you could have been when you were doing it, which I think must have been a lot of fun. And I also just sort of want to just jump into the CJ storyline real quick here, because I would argue it's the funniest part of the episode. She needs to go to the dentist and has been putting off going to the dentist. And then she goes to the dentist. She gets root canal and can't do the press conference. So Josh decides that he's going to do it. There's something amazing about his first line. Is are you sure you want your one question to be that stupid? Like, that's literally the first thing that he says to the first reporter, and it obviously spirals from there. What did you guys think about? Because I actually think that arrogant Josh, like, is the funniest, but also the most sort of intolerable when he's not being funny. Does that make sense? Do you know sort of what I'm getting at?
Yes, you mean when he's being arrogant, but the writing is not funny?
Correct. When Josh is just being like a blowhard, I'm just like, Josh, shut the fuck up. But then when he's being funny, like overtly funny, I think it's really, I don't know what you think.
I love, and actually this kind of expands to every character in this episode, is you really get a good distillation of all of their sort of core characteristics in this show. Except for Alice and Jan, well, I mean, CJ gets to do the physical comedy, which we'll get to, which is one of her great strengths on this show. But yeah, watching Josh and then using that, this one's less intolerable to your point, Phil, because it has this structure that it has where we are seeing him being hubristic and saying, I got this. Danny tries to stop him and he's like, he does a classic Aaron Sorkin and lists his qualifications. That's great. And then he gets up there being a real, real piece of shit, but juxtaposing that with him sheepishly recounting this story later, being like, yeah, I really fucked this up. Although at the same time, when he's telling the story to the college kids, he is just working the room. He is just eating up that affection. He is just, you get the full Josh in this episode.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that we get two different versions of arrogant Josh. Like, as we learn about Josh through the entire series, is that like his big issue is trying to prove that he belongs there and that he's smart. And that's what he's trying to do in the press room, is that he's trying to prove to everybody that he can do it and that he's the smartest one and that it's all going to be fine. Mm-hmm. But it comes off as him being a total dick to everybody. And then, you know, as he's telling the story, that's him with the public, which is a different Josh than
Totally.
With his peers in the public, he's like the hot one that, you know, the girls that the like the young co-eds are into. So that's like him telling the story. And so he's like trying to come off as like sweet and charming, which again is in his arrogance. And he knows that. And we see that. But it is, again, it's also, you know, it's Josh Lyman. So
the smile, the little smile, Whitford is such a good actor. The little smile he has when he gets the cell phone call and he has to go and he's being like, oh, sorry, I have to take
I'm so cool. Like,
I'm important. Hold on a moment. Like, I just, it's so good. He's so good.
Also, like, can we talk about how Bradley Whitford could not be manspreading any harder.
I noticed that.
How is he sitting?
He's so comfortable.
The soles of his feet are together and his knees are out. Insane. It's the best.
It is insane. And feels like it personifies perfectly what he's radiating on that stage. But it's just like, oh my God. Yeah. So the episode essentially opens with Josh on the stage being introduced. He's on the phone. He's talking to Sam. Sam's telling him that Mendoza has been arrested. He asked what he's been arrested for. He said he was arrested for driving while being Hispanic. And Sam tells CJ and Toby that Mendoza's in jail in Wesley, Connecticut. And you sort of basically, in sort of a classic Sorkin teaser cold open structure, he lays out all your storylines basically before the credits hit so that you at least know sort of where each person is headed. And we realize, obviously, CJ has this dentist appointment. Sam has this amazing line. Your teeth are the best friends you've got. You take care of them, they'll take care of you. When did you start talking like this? I'm nuts for dental hygiene. It's just, and this is what you're talking
about. Traeger. He's been Chris Traeger the entire time.
But it's also like, it's exactly what you were saying, Clay, of like everybody is dialed up to 11 a little bit. Like Sam's the most Sam, Toby's the most Toby, Josh is the most Josh, which is, I think, why fans love this episode as much as they do, because it's just the most kind of heightened version of everybody. We'll get to Sam actually using celestial navigation, as which feels like the most Sam thing to do as well. But we then meet HUD Secretary Deborah O'Leary, played by CCH Pounder, who was on a talk show and essentially kind of in a pretty... She called a Republican a racist in a way that was sort of, I don't know, not particularly articulate, just sort of like whatever. Basically, Bartlett is asked by Danny at a press conference about O'Leary, and then Bartlett says that she should apologize, and it creates a whole sort of to-do because there wasn't a press secretary there to basically usher Bartlett off of the stage faster. Yes. So now we have Sam and Toby lost trying to find the police station that Mendoza is being held at, a police station that is clearly a post facility on the Warner Brothers.
I was going to say, that building looks familiar.
It's just like, we'll put a sign here. It'll say police station and everyone will buy it, which is just amazing. I want to ask about this O'Leary storyline, because I think it's sort of, it's kind of dispensed with pretty quickly. Like it's pretty much done by the end of like the second act. And CCH Pounder is such a tremendous actor, and kind of wish that we got to see O'Leary again. It does kind of suck that she needs to apologize. Like, I think it's unfortunate that an African-American woman, African-American female character is sort of, you know, put in this box, but I'm curious as to what you guys think.
Yeah. I mean, this episode, that's not the only time in this episode where it's a group of white men telling somebody who is non-white that they shouldn't, confront the racism that they're being confronted with.
It's not.
So it's interesting that they double up on that in this episode. Yes. And especially now, so many years later, we have such a different perspective on that. Correct. So I don't know. There's kind of a lot to unfold there. And yet it is a bummer that it just kind of dissipate it by like being like, don't think about what this character is having to do because we're making the joke that like Bartlett just thought that her joke was bad. Like they're trying to like kind of wrap it up in that little like, we're on your side, but we're not going to say that publicly, which is the problem.
And it's the whole mission statement of Aaron Sorkin's moderate Democrat Clinton era thing, which is one of the parts that looks particularly naive today, is that, you know, yes, this is an indignity. Yes, this is wrong. But we have to play the game because the only way to affect change is by doing baby steps and, you know, get convincing people to be on our side and kind of sneaking in under the radar kind of thing. And that is, yes, that is the O'Leary thing. That is the Mendoza thing at the end of the episode, as Britt was referring to. Like, that is, that comes up a lot in The West Wing, is the, yes, idea that Republicans can be reasoned with and that both sides are playing fair in the game of Washington, and there's the way to do things, and we can do it without ruffling any feathers. And that, yes, especially in the Trump years now, has been so blown up and exposed as phony that is really one of the fantastical things that people don't really like anymore about the show.
Yeah.
But I think it's safe to say it's a stark example of that.
I imagine that Joe Manchin's a big fan of The West Wing. Let's put it that way. I do think that I agree with you, obviously, 100%. And that's actually an interesting, you know, Sorkin's political. He's not even like, every time we're in a election season, someone decides to poke Aaron Sorkin and ask him his thoughts on this because he wrote a show about politics. He's not a particularly political animal he's a classic boomer, right? Like, he's a guy who in the 60s was like, we got to dismantle the system. And now he's like, all right, everybody, like, let's all just relax a little bit. And like, let's find the middle ground, right. Which is sort of ironic. You know, he makes Chicago 7, which is, you know, the most boomer movie in terms of, you know, just sort of highlighting this moment and then not seeing how it actually really correlates to the political world that we live in today. But to your point, or more specifically to these two storylines, when it comes to diversity, it just rings of 1999. It just feels of a different time. And I'm not sort of sweeping that under the rug by any means, but it does feel like, it's not necessarily as they're just not willing to go there. They just don't really dig deep, and they just unfortunately, there's a lot of a white savior component to these two storylines anyway.
Well, that's a problem you set yourself up for when your entire primary cast is white, and then you want to fill in guest roles, yes, with people of color, and then, yes, you have created a situation where it's impossible for it not to take, yes, on that dynamic.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, and there's, I mean, throughout the entire series, there's so much of that where they're like, we're, you know, on the liberal end of things, but it's still like quite sexist and all these things. But then there's like little nods of like, yeah, but we, you know, give women this thing. And they're like, but yeah, not really. It's just like a little bit of that of trying to, again, it's the boomer thing of being like, yeah, no, we feel that way, but do we really, like, when it comes down to it?
It makes me often, as I watch this show, I've often been thinking about the sort of the road not taken. And I'm sure you guys know about the various casting that almost happened. But one of the people that that they tried to cast or almost cast as Bartlett was Sidney Poitier.
Right.
And there's a part of me that wonders what the show is like with that, right? Like, what is it? It would have had such a significant difference, right? It would have really been different.
Well, and I mean, that's interesting too, thinking of how initially Bartlett wasn't even supposed to be,
correct,
a main, yeah, character of that, if that was the initial thought. Again,
right,
that is even more of that, like, oh no, but we cast a black person, but initially, yeah, but they weren't even supposed, that wasn't a recurring
yeah, yeah,
role. Like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. So no, totally.
It's another example of that, like, we got you, yep, but not really.
Well, it's, you know, as I'm sure, Britt, you know, Sorkin got hit pretty hard at the TCAs when this pilot dropped, and by this specific thing. Why is this cast so white? Why is there no one? And Charlie is a reaction to that. I love Charlie's character, but it does not really deal with the problem, right? Like, Charlie's character is, you know, I can only assume the last one that sort of gets storylines. Everyone else gets storylines before him. And I love Dulejo's performance. I think he's tremendous, and I wish they gave Charlie more to do, but it does feel a little bit like this retroactive attempt to try to deal with something as opposed to really dealing with it. But so at this point, Allison Janney, or more specifically CJ, gets root canal. I love Josh getting her to say Foggy Bottom. It's just ridiculous. I'm not even going to try to do Allison Janney's accent, if that's the right word for when she has root canal, but it is comedy gold. We then are at the Danny asks about the president's plan to fight inflation. Josh says, yeah, Danny, we have a secret plan to fight inflation. Is just great. It's just watching Josh get taken down by this press corps is just a delight because of how arrogant he is, obviously. We then cut back to Josh at the school, and some college girl goes up to him and says, you're great. She's like, what is this? Like, there's this ridiculous perception that the deputy chief of staff would be like hot to young college girls is just absurd.
And
but
also,
I mean,
God,
Britt, as I want to hear Britt's thoughts.
Oh, Britt's
100%
in love with Josh Lyman, but it must have rankled Rob Lowe so much.
Of course,
that fucking Bradley Whitford with his receding hairline is emerges as the hot guy of the show, and he's playing this like doofus character.
It's great. So, I will say, I was in college when I first came to this show, and I'm pretty sure that I have had a very consistent crush on Josh Lyman. I don't think it's grown as I've grown older. I think it's always been there. I don't know what Bradley Whitford does, but it just works very well on me as a straight woman.
it should be said that before we got on mic, Clay said that I should that I should have introduced you as the creator of LemonLyman.com. So, I mean, was he your crush on this of this cast more so than Rob Lowe?
Oh, absolutely. Rob Lowe doesn't do it for me.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Fair enough. So arrogance is seems to be an aphrodisiac for you when it comes to, okay, good to know. I'm curious about the sort of, this also kind of feeds into the Sorkin idea of like super smart people are really sexy to women. Like, I think he likes to perpetuate this idea. And you see it in Studio 60 as well. The idea that like the showrunners of SNL would have people asking for their autographs is quite frankly laughable. I just, you know, he has this weird perception of this stuff.
Especially like young guys who, I mean, yeah. Lorne Michaels, the historical real life precedent for that type of thing, is extremely famous. And people probably would ask him for his autograph.
I will say, I don't know what Lorne Michaels looks like.
There it is.
But people who are big fans of Saturday Night Live certainly know who Lorne Michaels is.
Do those people wait outside the doors? And
Phil, like, are you saying that there are not fans of SNL who wait outside the doors and might ask Lorne Michaels for his autograph? Because I think probably 100%.
That seems okay. I'm not gonna. I mean, it seems a little silly to me, but I hear you. Fandom is fandom.
Look, and everything in Studio 60 is silly.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough. So at this point, Toby is on the cell phone with Josh in the car. Sam is driving. He thought he was following celestial navigation and thought he was following the North Star, but it turned out that it was the Delta shuttle from LaGuardia. And it's just great. Toby being, it's the most sort of grumpy Toby of just being like, please just get me where we need to go. Why am I not driving? Like just all of that energy. They get to the police station. Sam's first line is, I think if we stayed on the Mare Parkway, we wouldn't have ended up in Bridgepoint so many times, is fucking incredible. So many times is the key to that.
And he, again, and Rob Lowe sells it so well. I mean, yeah, this is a very, very funny episode. And then, but then this is also, yeah, Toby's being a major grump. This is, as you said, a dialed up to 11 Toby. Yes. I want to see a bottle episode, and maybe there was one that I forget, where it is just him and Sam stuck in the car the entire time.
Yeah.
Because their banter is fantastic.
Thing is the best.
Their buddy thing is the best. Their planes, trains, and automobiles thing is fantastic. Yes. And then we get to see the full Sam. He's the total silly, like, idiot. And then he walks into the police station and turns on, like, I work for the president and blah, blah, and like totally like gives it to this guy. And that is his whole thing, is he disarms you by being the like, absent-minded professor. Right. And then he turns it on you and locks in and you're like, oh, shit. And that's
he's a Merrill Lynch lawyer. Like he's lawman. Like he ticks in as being just like, you know, he gets shit done.
I so I did a little reading up on this episode, and there are a fair amount of people that push back on some of the things that happen in this episode from a storytelling perspective. And one of them is the coincidence of the cops having a paper that just happens to have Toby on the front page of it.
I mean, I think
it's
that
television. Have these people never watched television before?
It's television, Christ. But also they use that again in what, in 20 Hours in America, where they're just like on the TV as they're talking to a person. I mean, what, it doesn't bug me because whatever, it's funny.
It's whatever, yeah.
But, and again, too, like, why would they be on the cover of the newspaper? Like, they're staff, like, they're not, to us, they're famous because they're on the West Wing, but like, that role is not a person who would be on the cover of a newspaper or on front page.
Yeah, no, the communications director would go out of his way not to be on the cover of the paper.
Yeah, that,
especially Toby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is what doesn't make sense, is that Toby is like standing behind Bartlett looking over his shoulder. Toby would be hiding.
Yeah, no, for sure. So then we have Donna rushing to Josh's side post-briefing saying, oh my God, Josh. Oh my God, Josh, this is so bad. This is so bad. He's got like flop sweat. He almost looks like Albert Brooks in Broadcast News, where he's just like just sweating and looks like a crazy person.
Oh, I love that they like cut back to the tight shot and somebody was like, ooh, let's spray a bunch of sweat on his face. It just like immediately shows up. It's like somebody was just like, oh, this will be funny. So great.
Totally. Then we find out that Mendoza told the press that Bartlett was wrong to make O'Leary apologize, which is correct, which is accurate. And then Josh explains to the audience that Mendoza was very outspoken. Toby speaks with Mendoza in the jail cell. And this is what you were talking about earlier, Britt, about...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Toby essentially saying to Mendoza, do you want to get on the Supreme Court? If you want to get on the Supreme Court, you got to eat crow and you've got to deal with this. And we've got to put this to bed. If you want to fight this fight, which on some level, I think he does respect the fight. Like, I don't think that Toby is saying that what Mendoza believes in is not worth believing.
That's Toby's,
in, but yeah,
that's Toby's colonel. Yeah. That's his DNA, entire thing is he is the most fiery, fervent liberal in the entire administration, and then he is always the one who has to convince other people to play the game. Like, he is the number one operator and suppressing his – he's the boomer you were talking about. He's the guy who was marching in the 60s, and now – that's why he's always so grumpy, is because he is at conflict with himself at all times, and I think on some level resents what he's become.
His sisters took him to the marches when they took him out of elementary school so that he could march in those marches.
See, it's funny you say that, because I do think that of all the voices on the show, I think Toby's the most Sorkin. He's the writer.
He's Sorkin.
I mean, he's like, that feels the most Sorkin-esque, which is why it's just so frustrating to see where we are now and that he's still, anyway. Doesn't matter. The green lighting in the jail cell, I thought the lighting in that cell was really interesting. Like, I do think that this show is very cinematic, really beautifully shot. It doesn't get enough credit for, I think, really pushing the ball down the field in terms of like television becoming a lot more cinematic, a lot more filmic in the way that it's shot. I mean, it's very Robert Richardson with its hot lighting and all that sort of stuff, but it still just it doesn't feel like a television show.
Did Robert Richardson shoot this?
No, but he shot The American President, and I think that that there's definitely some
Well, that was all, Phil, that's all, I mean, you've been doing the ER series too. That was whole NBC's whole thing at this time. They were the first broadcast network to start doing shows in 16:9. And I remember that vividly when that happened, when ER started doing it, and then the West Wing did it, and I they may have had some other drama. Maybe Law and Order did it. I don't remember. But
I'm sure Third Watch and their other shows.
It stood out so much, and it just felt – you looked at an episode of ER and then just something that was happening concurrently on ABC or CBS, and it looked like movies versus –
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because there's two things. The first is a lot of Steadicam work, a lot of long, you know, walk and talks. That's one of the main things of this show. But ER kind of did it first. I mean, they had a lot of Steadicam work going on that show as well. But then, Britt, in terms of the production design, it's, you know, ER was the first set to have a ceiling. It was the first set because they knew that they were going to see the ceiling from time to time. And they so it literally... And I don't know if the West Wing had the same thing, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on sort of the production design of this show. I mean, it's a lot of glass. It's a lot of being able to see things through things and what have you. But it's a really warm, inviting environment. But I'm sort of curious what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that it's really warm. It definitely, like, they build the office out to feel like it is their home. And, you know, with how we see all of the walk and talks, it's like you know exactly how this space is set up. Like, they really give it that full 360 degrees, like, lived in feel. And again, it is interesting, once they then hop out, they hop out of that, you can really see the difference there and what happens with, like, you know, they get the again station. They get to play or not, if they just want to they just want to pass by that,
right.
But no, it was great. And I mean, like, one thing, I don't know, it has such great details too, with, like, CJ and her fish and, like, things like that, those details that play so much when they're not, you know, throughout the entire series. It's great.
Yeah, they can't, that's a good point, Britt. They can't suddenly have a dramatic scene in Toby's office with a stark green light because the audience would be like,
what's happening?
Wait a minute. Yeah.
Alien.
There's not usually a dramatic green light in that room. Where the fuck did that come from?
It's interesting too. You know, I was thinking, Britt, as you were talking about sort of the extent that the stages had to be in order to get these walk and talks, right? Like, he wants, and by he I mean Sorkin and Tommy Shalami, want sort of these long, sort of circuitous pathways. And generally speaking, your stages don't do that, right? Like, you usually have a couple rooms that abut up against each other, but this is like, there's a lot. Like, I'm in my brain just thinking about what stuff walks into what, and it's really extensive.
Oh yeah, there's so much into mapping all of that out that is so detailed and meticulous that works so well. And there's not, like, I don't know, it does, it works so well. There's rarely times where you're like, oh, how did they get there? Like, it moves so well.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
They established the space really, really well. And I have to imagine with stuff like The West Wing, stuff like ER, and actually when I was a PA briefly on Mad Men, the Sterling Cooper Draper Price office was like this as well, where with the contiguous set, I think it helps the actors. It helps make you feel like you're really there, because you would walk up on that set, and I assume The West Wing was the same way, and you could forget that you were on a soundstage. You could just feel like you are there in the space. And I have to imagine that played into why these characters also feel so natural, feel so at home. You know, the movement becomes so ingrained as, like, almost part of their personalities, because they have this space where they feel like they're really living there.
Well, sure. And it speaks to just production design in general. I mean, I've been on shows where you walk onto a stage or you walk into a room and the detail is so impressive that it does, you're just like, this feels like a lived in space. This feels like and if you don't have that, I can't imagine how much harder it is as an actor to get yourself into this headspace of, like, this is really happening. And it's why I think people don't give enough credit to it, but it's also why people, when you see bad production design, it takes you out of stuff. It's so incredibly important to selling you on all of it. So we do get a really great, fun bit with Charlie and Bartlett in this episode as where Charlie calls the president for a wake-up call, and the president is very tired and unsure as to what's going on. And Charlie says, "Sir, I need you to dig in now," which is fantastic. But then when he goes up to the residence, Bartlett still isn't awake yet. So he goes into the bedroom, he wakes him up, and Bartlett grabs his hand, like kind of like angrily. And then Bartlett says to Charlie, "Have you slept yet?" Charlie says, "No, sir." And Bartlett says, "Good." It's I do love this father-son power dynamic that exists. Like the kind of the only power that Charlie has over the president is his schedule, right? And being able to sort of corral him. And I love how this show embraces those moments and lets Charlie get to sort of, you know, smack him around a little bit. It's fun.
Yeah, that relationship is so fun. And again, we get the full range of what Martin Sheen can do almost in this episode as well. You don't get, you know, like a Two Cathedrals type moment, but you get him. He doesn't scream at God in this episode. He only does that in the one
in
episode.
Latin.
In Latin. Well, but he has his controlling the room president scene, and then he has his being the kind of petulant, silly. Sheen can play this comedy. Everyone on this cast. This is why I love the show. Is it kind of is most of the time a dramedy, but like Sheen plays the comedy so adeptly and can play like a petulant little kid. I've always wondered about this with the possible Sidney Poitier casting is like Poitier certainly can command a room and exudes gravitas, but I mean, maybe he just never had the opportunity in his career to also show that other more comedic.
Sneakers is the only thing that comes to mind, but yeah. I agree with you. He never really did a ton of comedy. Britt, did you look like you were going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to, you know, jump off of that with, yes, Martin Sheen can command a room and yell at God, but it is, to me, it's so much more interesting when he shows up and he's in a t-shirt or in a sweatshirt. Yes. Like that's when you know it's going to be good. That's like when the like folksy thing comes out and when he is just like a dorky dad. Yes. Like he's such a dorky dad to everybody that works for him. And then, you know, to Leo, he's a brother. Like it's just that like family thing comes out when he isn't in his suit. And you get a little bit of that, and it's just
You know, it's if he's wearing a Georgetown, a Notre Dame sweatshirt or anything along those lines, you know that you've got some good stuff coming. Especially if he's taken his back meds, that's also good stuff too. The Toby Mendoza stuff really is kind of the end of the episode where Toby is talking about. Asked Mendoza why he refused to take the breathalyzer. Mendoza says that it wasn't just cause, it was an illegal search. And essentially, as I said earlier, Toby says to him, if you want to be a Supreme Court justice, you've got to play ball under these circumstances. He explains that it obviously the situation stinks and what have you. I don't know that Toby could make all of this go away. Like there's a little bit of like magic going on at the end of this episode where he's just like, it's like he's got that Men in Black thing and he's able to like zap the cops and make them forget that any of this happened. But that's television.
I chalk that up to more. There's some stuff we didn't see with. He says the governor's on the phone or something. So I feel like there's
something going on.
When
Toby's talking to Mendoza, Sam is doing the paperwork.
Sam is just dressing down the two sheriffs off screen.
The episode ends as it began with us back with Josh in front of the students. And he says, you know, you should call me back. I'll tell you what happened. Because he obviously can't loop them in on what's happened with Mendoza. I do kind of wish we got another Josh in front of this class. Or it would have been nice to kind of – I don't need to see him obviously tell us what happened or what we saw with Mendoza. But it just would have been nice to see him in a circumstance like that again. I know that it only happened the one time. But it would have been nice. So I've been asking all of my guests at the ends of these episodes what their favorite episodes of The West Wing are. Now, Clay's eyebrows just went because Clay doesn't know the episode titles of this show as well as perhaps Britt does. Britt, I'm going to ask you first then. What are some of your favorite episodes?
Okay, I also don't know the episode titles, but
okay, that's fine.
I love. Oh my gosh, there's so many.
Yeah, the thing is, there's a lot of episodes of this show, and they're all good.
I want to just fully admit that I fucked up here, which is that every other guest I in the email said, I'm also going to ask you for some of your favorite episodes. So there was a they were given time to think about this. So I just want to say to our listeners that I blindsided both of my guests with this question. So that's what that is.
Now it's like I'm trying to even like pull out favorite moments rather
okay.
than
okay yeah we could do that too
episodes,
for sure
just
how about this are there together. Do you have favorite characters or is do you have a favorite character Britt do you have a character that has stayed with you perhaps more than others maybe a recurring character if not a series regular
I mean I love Josh
we've covered that
we know this
love Josh.
Love Josh. I love Zoe yes. In the first few seasons. Mm-hmm.
I love Josh yes. also. But the thing I found this interesting when I watched it the second time was, you know, sometimes you watch a show a second time, a third time, and you start focusing on a different character. Maybe there was a character that drew a lot of attention the first time around. Like sure. the first time I watched Arrested Development, I was all about Job. I was like, Will Arnett's the funniest person who's ever lived. And then, sure. like, the second season, there's the second time I watched it all the way through, I was like, oh, actually, David Cross might be the funniest person ever. When I watched The West Wing the first time through, I was like, oh, man, Team Josh all the way. Mm-hmm. And then, mm-hmm. actually, I think Toby kind of slowly became perhaps mm-hmm. my favorite character on the show. But I will say, instead of – the only episodes that I remember off the top of my head are the really yeah. dramatic –
Two Cathedrals, sure.
Two Cathedrals, the one where Josh is having his Christmas PTSD flashbacks Noel. With yeah, Adam yeah. Arkin. Yeah, Noel. Those ones, like, those are the ones that kind of stick out in your memory. The one where Mark, where my favorite character, Mark Harmon, gets killed.
Sure.
Crime Boy, also, I don't know, yeah. all that stuff. those are the things that stick out, but those are probably yeah. not, you know, my favorite episodes. Like you said, like, this episode yeah. is a fan favorite. You know, 2 months ago, if you had said, oh, Celestial Navigation, or even said, oh, it's the one where they go pick up Mendoza, I would have been like, yeah, I kind of remember that. But watching, they're like, well, this is great. This is exactly what the West Wing – this is exactly what the West Wing is. They have a phrase that they say 45 times, secret plan for to solve inflation. It's classic. It's classic Sorkin shit. But I will say – so I'll take kind of a macro angle on this question. I really like – the season 6 and 7 arc with Jimmy Smits getting convinced sure. to run for president, building his campaign, going on the road, and then becoming president. I really, really like that stuff. And I often say that I think season 7 is basically good enough to be considered with the Sorkin years.
I fully agree with that. Fully agree with that. I watched 5, 6, and 7 actually during the election, just apropos of just wanting to watch it again, and having not seen 5 and 6 that often.
5 is tough.
Five's tough.
Is a rough one.
Five's bumpy. I don't see myself maybe going back to 5 again. But 6 surprised me. I think I clumped them together unfairly. 6 has, to your point, a lot of really great stuff in terms of the birth of the Santos character and really kind of laying a lot of really great piping for 7. And I think 7 is fantastic. And I do wish that we got one season of a Santos administration. It would have been interesting to see what that looked like. There were so many great characters that they brought in. I mean, Jimmy Garofalo and any number of people that it would have been just phenomenal to see that get a shot. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's interesting over the course of all these episodes, you know, you have a lot of Two Cathedrals. I mean, it is obviously a tremendous episode. A lot of In the Shadow of Two Gunmen, the two-parter at the top of season 2 after Josh gets shot, which is tremendous. And is sort of, I mean, I think they're probably my favorite episodes just because you get to see how everybody came into the administration.
The flashbacks in those episodes are so fun. I mean, those two episodes are just so well made. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking.
I'm getting goosebumps. I vividly remember my mother, my sister here, and myself sobbing uncontrollably when Josh gets shot. And the way that the way they reveal that stuff, did I not know?
Yeah. You didn't know who got shot when you
I might have I honestly might have because I saw that one fresh and that's the end of season 1 mm-hmm. so I must have started I think I maybe I watched maybe 7 or 8 episodes, and then I was going home for winter break, and I was like, okay, Britt and Mom get caught up, and we're gonna keep
do
going
this together.
On this. But like that one, and then is that the one where we meet where we see Donna joining the campaign early on? Because all that stuff is I love the flashbacks it's and the scene at the airport with when is it Josh's dad dies. And Bartlett shows up at the airport.
And Bartlett shows up.
Yeah. And yeah, these all the same episode.
Can I come with you?
Yeah,
I
come with you.
All of the best moments of the show are in this one 45-minute episode.
It's incredible. It's an incredible episode. I've said this before, but I think that season 2 of the show is a perfect season of television. It just comes back on itself so perfectly.
Yeah.
It's a show at the peak of its powers.
The Mrs. Landingham flashback episode. Boy, Jed. If that's two cathedrals. They're all this, man.
You literally love the classic West Coast show. But I think great episodes.
But like I said, those are the ones that have those moments that stick in your head.
Yes, of course,
for me.
Of course.
Yeah. But it's entirely possible that the random mid-season episodes.
There are great. Please.
I love the big block of cheese episodes.
Yes.
I love those. I love our main characters having the way that they think, and then being like, you know, annoyed that they have to listen to somebody else, and then it cracks their heart open a little bit, and we leave them in a different place, and we found them. Like, they're so simple and lovely, and it's always, you know, good comedy in those.
Absolutely.
And it's nice to see, it's great to see these people who, again, with Josh as an example, like, think that they are smart and right always, and then to see, like, and that's what all of these characters, they all have that. Like, that's, I think, part of what gets you, you know, to work in the White House. Then to see them having to listen to other people and have it change their minds is just nice little moments and reminders that people are people and can hear new opinions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Mary Louise Parker.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Amy Gardner, the greatest.
Yes.
And Marlee Matlin, actually. Yeah. I think it speaks.
Yeah,
I think it speaks
great.
It speaks to Josh's character that he is attracted to all of these terrific women.
I would agree, and that they're attracted to him. Does that say something about his character? Perhaps.
I mean, it must. It must.
Two things that I want to speak of. The first is Britt, what you were talking about with the big block of cheese stuff. It's what you want from politicians, right? That they can be open-minded enough that they can see something and that their minds can be changed about something. The cartographers in when they show up and they show them what the earth really looks like, and it just blows their minds. And to your point, Clay, in terms of Mary Louise Parker, who Sorkin notoriously tried to sign her as a series regular and did not want to be a series regular on the show. I think it's better that Amy Gardner wasn't a series regular. I love Amy Gardner, and I'm sure I would have loved her as a series regular. But that idea of how he understood how to weaponize these supporting recurring characters, right? Like, Joey Lucas is a tremendous character, and she's used perfectly on the show and weaponized perfectly on the show. And this is all to underline, and I have to get your thoughts on this before we wrap up, is Mandy. You know, Mandy is a character that existed in season 1 of this show and is a perfect example of, you know, a series regular that shouldn't have been a series regular, right? Like a role within the administration that didn't need that much screen time and didn't need that much real estate. And it's a lesson that was learned, unfortunately, at the cost of Moira Kelly, who's a great actor. But I just think there's something to be said for that. Do you guys have thoughts on Mandy? Do you wish that Mandy stuck around? Do you miss Mandy?
I don't wish she had stuck around. I'm glad that she didn't. Freed her up to go do One Tree Hill.
That's true. Thank God.
I think.
Wait, is that? I mean, is that where Mandyville is? Is One Tree
and
One Mandy Tree Hill is
One Tree
Mandyville?
Hill. That's where it is. That's for sure.
It is.
It takes place in Mandyville.
To think of how she is different than like the other supporting, specifically women that kind of cycled through, in that she kind of at the end of it, like they can't trust her. Like that's her character differs in that way. Whereas these other people that kind of cycled in, like especially with Mary Louise Parker, like her as a person, she was too good to like be part of the administration. Yeah, like right. That was like her whole argument, was that like she isn't meant to work in the system. Like she's meant to fight for yeah. what she believes in. And like that's kind of what they used as the thing to like keep her kind of on the outskirts and to like move her through. Right. Whereas mm-hmm. with Mandy, they gave us that like she had the memo floating around that she wanted to like work for a conservative. Like they gave, just as a character, the things that they gave her to kind of keep her on the outskirts just are unsavory and not in a fun way.
Right. I agree. I think that, you know, there's been, as you can imagine, a fair amount of discussion of Mandy over the course of this podcast. And, you know, a lot of people felt similarly, and a lot of people also felt as though, because she was sort of an antagonist within the administration, she became annoying. Do you know what I mean? And you sensed it in the writers of being like, we want these people to just be unencumbered and to allow themselves to right. just be the most sort of the purest version of themselves. And then at each episode, you've got Mandy being like, being like a narc all the time, being like, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Right.
And it just didn't play well.
Because in the macro sense, it is this unit, this family,
yeah,
going towards one goal against these external forces.
Right.
And they can all bicker and get on each other's nerves on a moment-to-moment basis, which is, you get some great of that in this episode. Mm-hmm. There's some great scenes. And it's this writing and this cast that can have a whole scene where everybody is just bitching at each other and belittling each other, but it's yes. still, it feels warm. And you know that the next time they see each other, you know, except for Toby, it's going to have dissipated and like reset. Yes. And I think, yeah, Mandy being in the middle of that, and even in this episode you see, I mean, she's on the out, she's in one scene and you're like, oh shit, Mandy.
Yeah. And then she,
but she's not part of any of the scenes where everybody's together getting their assignments or anything. Yeah, if she is yeah, like kind of a detractor, as you were saying, like within that group, it's, they just figured out that chemistry wasn't the way they wanted to write scenes. I'm sure that they would, however many episodes went by, and they're like, oh, we just didn't put Mandy in any of these scenes because we just, what we have to do with her, to Britt's point, yes. because of what yes. we've established her character as, is mm-hmm. just not fun.
Working.
It's a yeah. sour note. It's not what we want to play.
There's two things that came to mind as you were talking. The first is one of my favorite moments in this episode as well is later in the episode, or it might be, forgive me, it might be early in the episode, when someone's wondering how Mendoza got to Connecticut or how how he's driving, and Sam knows the route.
Yeah.
And Toby's like, there's something freakish about you, which is fantastic. But on the Mandy front, you know, this is also another example of casting, right? Which is, you know, if you... you cast Janelle as Donna, and it's just, there's an immediate chemistry going on between her and Josh. On some level,
yeah.
Mandy's days are numbered from the first scene that Donna has with Josh, because then the only reason to keep Mandy around is if she has this potential romance
right.
with Josh.
It's so
weird. And then
weird.
That never manifests.
It's so weird to remember, you look at the pilot and they set that thread up and you're like,
yeah.
Ah, oh, that's weird.
it's so weird.
With Janelle Maloney, like, it's another thing. This show truly, and again, you don't really get this anymore. On, at least, I don't know, I don't watch a lot of network television. I don't watch a lot of episodic television anymore, but you certainly don't get this in prestige television where everything is beat out, everything is figured out before you ever start shooting. Like they figured out, while making the show, how much to use Martin Sheen. They figured out, like, Janelle Maloney... she's not even a recurring in the first season, really. She pops up here and there. She's a guest star, I think, is how she's credited.
She's a guest star, yeah.
And she's not even in the opening credits until, is she in season two or season three?
Season two, she's in two. She's
so they figure out Janelle Maloney as they go, how much Donna, how what the relationship is with her. They figure out that they miscalculated Mandy. Like,
oh,
you get
sure.
to watch this stuff grow. And I think going through those growing pains and seeing what works and what doesn't, you know, I think that is, you know, something that leads to oftentimes more potent, more involving, more engaging stories and television shows that most shows these days don't have the opportunity to do. There's kind of a cap on how how well they can work, because it is more like developed like a movie. It's just going to be the original idea executed from point A to point B. Whereas if it's more of a living, breathing organism like television used to be, it creates this, it raises the ceiling for how totally. How great the show can become.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the evolution you're talking about. So many shows now are kind of made in a vacuum. At least a first season of a show generally sort of exists before it's exposed to the audience. And then they're like, okay, well, now we have feedback and now we're going to do this, this, and this with season two. This show, you know, they probably had three, maybe four episodes in the can before, you know, they started airing them and they start seeing how people are responding to things. It should be said, though, that John Spencer did suss this out from the pilot. Apparently, Janelle Maloney said that the first scene she has, Leo walks up to her and says, is Josh there? And she yells over her shoulder, Josh. And he says, I could have done that. Anyway, they do the scene and he turns to Janelle and says, you're going to be here until the curtain comes down. Like, he just knew just out of the gate that, like, this was working. And I just feel like Mandy it's just unfortunate, right? It happens. This is just television and it's just the way that things work. But I do think that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, Britt, on the Josh and Donna relationship, because it has sort of not aged as well as maybe we would like it to. I think that there is an undeniable chemistry between them, but there's a power dynamic at play that is a little bit icky now. What are your feelings on their relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously like fun to watch, you know, sure. Without dissecting. I don't know. Yeah. It's like, yeah. It's one of those that you, a lot of how this show treats women is something that you don't want to like,
think too hard on,
because then it doesn't feel good, you know. Yes, it's like, sure, and you sure, have sure. to like watch it with that yeah. removed veil. But I mean, some of the Josh and Donna stuff is like, I mean, I wouldn't stop for red lights. Like, some of these moments are just like so perfect. Yeah. And it's so lovely, but it also gives room for Josh to like go. I mean, it sucks that he like then, yes. you know, goes and is dating all these women. And I mean, it's all very normal. Like, it's not like yeah. it's about that. But I'm just saying, like, yeah. you know, it's that missing out on what's right in front of you. But the power structure is very strange. But also, she has a lot of power over him
yes.
that,
on a
you know, yeah. they on a, don't yeah. like. Yeah. That she clearly has so much power and has ever since she walked in. And like, once we see, like, I don't know, she's a lot, I think they don't give her, they don't show a lot of degrees of her character. Mm-hmm. Like, they mm-hmm. show her taking care of Josh and like fitting in as one of the women of the office. But like mm-hmm. in the flashbacks, like when she shows up and just like takes over and is like answering his phone, like mm-hmm. they don't, again, it speaks a little bit to like the sexism that lives within our world of that Donna didn't get promoted, or like they touched a little bit on her trying to be headhunted away from her job and like getting offered a lot of money, but like she decided to stay. I don't know. I think that could have been,
yeah,
they could have talked about that and had that play up a lot more. And when she eventually does leave, like, I'm so glad she leaves. Yes. to go, like, yeah. it sucks because it's weird because that like whole timing, I don't know, it's just a weird part of the series, but like it is good that she leaves and works separate from him before they mm-hmm. ultimately get together.
I think that, you know, it's clear that Sorkin, I think, said it early on, like, that these two were not going to get together during the run of this show. I think that them sticking to that, first of all, helps with the will they, won't they, but maybe more importantly, they don't get together until they're on a level playing field professionally, or at least close mm-hmm. to being on a level playing field. If they had ever hooked up as assistants, it would have been
bad.
And then that would have forced Sorkin to deal with, I think, some yeah. drama within his White House that he had no interest in.
Exactly.
Also, at that time, if you're making a show that is essentially the Clinton White House, you're not doing that.
You don't
want
to go there.
You're not doing that.
No.
That would have been a bad idea.
Yes. Well, guys, thank you so, so much for coming on and talking about celestial navigation.
This is so much fun.
I really, really appreciate it. And Clay, I hope that you'll come back. And Britt, I hope you'll come back. We did talk. So the next series that I'm doing, and we're going to cut this so it doesn't matter, but doing Dawson's Creek next.
I just watched through Dawson's Creek for the first time. Did we talk about this the other day?
I think we talked a little bit about it when we went to see Fast 9. So I'd love for you to come on for a Dawson's Creek episode if you're open to that.
I am. And I've got other people that would be interested. If
fantastic. Because I'm going to need humans.
I've never seen an episode. Can I watch one out of context?
That'd be great. Would you come on out of context
and watch which one? Episode he watches?
Yes. Completely out of context, knowing nothing about
it. I've never seen the show. I can never remember. I remember Joshua Jackson's name, but Katie Holmes. Katie Holmes is one of those actor names that I can never remember. It's like her and
really?
And I'm going to forget
really
it because this is the premise
doing
of what
it right
I'm saying.
Now.
The guy from Office Space.
Oh, Ron Livingston.
I can never remember Ron Livingston's name ever.
That's incredible. That's
Phil,
amazing.
I'd love to do an out of context Dawson's Creek. I also. If you want to talk, if you want to see more CCH Pounder, I mean, The Shield is a seminal.
That's not a 99, though.
Didn't it premiere in 99? Or is it a 2000? I thought it was 99.
Now I'm looking. If The Shield is 99, then I'm fucking in. But I'm almost positive.
I thought The Shield was the year.
2002 to 2008.
2002. Fuck.
Sorry,
that's disappointing.
Which season of Dawson's Creek is 99?
It is the end of 2 and the top of 3.
That
facial response was, I don't even know what it was. You're just like, all right.
It was like, is that a good part?
It's in the good times. It's at least when it was good. Like, well, it goes flying off the
but
rails.
But was that, it just, there's some, I watched it all in 1 month, so I don't know what this season is.
A month?
Are,
you watched all of it?
I think so. A month or two?
Here's what breaks my heart about you watching Dawson's Creek like that, which is that you didn't have the theme song.
Okay, it sucked so bad, but I did. They brought it back for the series finale. They paid for it on Netflix. So
oh my God.
I
picked one episode.
It sucks, but fucking like lame. I was watching the finale with two girlfriends who, two of us had never seen the finale before, and one of them was a friend who like watches shows but doesn't watch the finale of them. And so she was watching the finale. And the song came on, and I, like, flipped out because I didn't know it was coming, and I knew it was a thing that I had been missing, so I had just kind of, like, built it up so much, and
it's
then it came on.
It's so important. It's anyway,
so important.
It's crazy to me to not have that is just so disappointing.
Phil, I'm looking at 1999 television shows. If you ever do anything about Zaboomafoo, I'm your guy. Let's see
Boomafoo?
What else. Yo, you don't know Zaboomafoo?
It's about a lemur who leaps.
It's two brothers who are
the Krat brothers.
The Krat brothers who are naturalists, and they had a PBS show, and they had a sidekick who was a lemur, who was sometimes a real lemur and sometimes a puppet.
I have no idea what you're speaking of. It's like another language.
Zaboomafoo. I liked their show before Zaboomafoo as well. I was a big Krat brothers guy. Oh, that first season of, I wouldn't want to do a series on this, but I think it would be fascinating to look at the first season of Family Guy on an intellectual level, because that was such a weird phenomenon. Well, now it's like the Family Guy, whatever, at that time it was wild.
I am absolutely going to do an episode on Family Guy. The only shows that I'm doing a series on, I'm going to do a Dawson's Creek. I refuse to do Buffy because I don't want to I will do a Buffy episode, but I don't want to do a Joss Whedon fucking miniseries.
Sure.
I'm not interested in doing that. Perhaps Ally McBeal. I might do a couple of those because that was a big show. X-Files, obviously, Simpsons. I mean, like, there are still a fair amount of shows that I want to definitely do at least one episode of because I feel like to not would be unfair. But yeah, Dawson's Creek is the next miniseries. You guys feel free to pick your episodes now while they're up for grabs. But I'll probably start recording those in, I don't know, September or something like that, maybe October.
I'm not picking my episode. It sounds like Brit is picking
your episode.
Yeah, I'll pick his episode.
I can't wait. Thank you so much, guys. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil. Good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me,
Brit. Bye, always a pleasure.
It's so formal.
Nice to see you, Clay.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.